طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin on a sad note this morning. As announced earlier by Bob Funk, longtime Truth and Justice radio host Steve Corney passed away in September from the ravages of colon cancer at age 59, much too early. For many years, Steve co-hosted Truth and Justice Radio with Stan Robinson. He was a great friend and supporter of This Week in Palestine. He had a calmness and patience with radio novices like myself when we broke into broadcasting, but he also had a fierce rage about the injustices he saw all about him. That is what drove him to Truth and Justice Radio. And he fought those injustices by revealing them on this radio show. He used his program to raise the voices of those who suffered injustice and fought injustice, which gave hope to all of us who work to bring a new day when justice will be won for those who suffer from oppression and discrimination. The world is a better place because of Steve Corney's rage, commitment, dedication, and work. We will miss his voice. This week we feature presentations from the annual Tree of Life Conference that circulates through the Northeast each year, raising the Palestinian voice. Recording in the church venues where the conferences are held is challenging, with poor acoustics, mediocre sound systems, and as you will hear today, crying children. However, This Week in Palestine cares more about the content of presentations rather than the sound quality, although our sound editor, Steve Robinson, often works miracles in improving the quality of sound in many of our presentations. So with those caveats, we will bring you speeches by Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey, and author Mark Braverman. As you know, Rachel Corey was killed by a bulldozer that was about to demolish a Palestinian home in 2003. Her mother and father have taken up her cause of working for Palestinian rights, which brought them to the Tree of Life Conference. First, you will hear Cindy Corey, followed by Craig.
Born in 1979, nearly 12 years after the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and the Shabbat Farms by Israel, and over 30 years after the dispossession of the Palestinian people during the Nakba, our family at the time knew no Palestinians, not in Olympia, Washington, where we lived, nor anywhere else in the world. Nor could we have imagined how the Palestinian people would one day become a part of Rachel's life and of our own. As a child, Rachel had dreams. She was an adventurer. In 1990, in her fifth grade yearbook, she wrote, "I want to be a lawyer, a dancer, an actress, a mother, a wife, a children's author, a distance runner, a poet, a pianist, a pet store owner, an astronaut, an environmental and humanitarian activist, a psychiatrist, a ballet teacher, and the first woman president. And I can't help but think that she and Lama in Gaza were wonderful friends. Rachel was an observer in our family, and always a reader and writer, someone compelled to create. She said, "I write because in some secret compartment in my brain, this little ironclad woman keeps screaming, 'It's all you have.' Writing is brave. It is maybe the only brave thing about me." Rachel loves Seattle and our northwest mountains, forests, and the sea. And as a college student, she wrote, "You can live here for years and believe you understand, and yet not understand what it is you are living in. I'm glad I know about the people who lived on Elk Inlet. I'm glad I know about the internment of Nisqually people on Fox Island. We're traditionally presented with history as a thing that happened somewhere else, certainly nothing to intervene in. Studying the history of this area roots me. It makes me more conscious of the land and more conscious of myself and of the people around me as actors in history. We've certainly waded in the same water and wandered on the same beaches as very brave people. It makes bravery seem more possible." After 9/11, Rachel became deeply involved with several Olympia peace groups. She opposed the Iraq War, and she led an effort to create a human flock of doves for Olympia's Earth Day tribute to honor all of life, called the Procession of the Species. She celebrated after, and she wrote, "I've danced down the street with 40 people from the ages of 7 to 70 dressed as doves. The procession is a values statement. I'm happy to see a peace message included in that. It's important for people who oppose war and repression to speak about who we are as a community, in addition to speaking about war and racism and injustice. We are not outside. It's important that human rights and resistance to oppression be included in the way we define ourselves as a community." Rachel was drawn to the issue of Palestine after 9/11 when she met with those in our community who had strong connections to the issue. She read, she learned, she studied Arabic. And in her journal, she wrote, "Why do I want to go? I've been organizing in Olympia for a little over a year on anti-war global justice issues. And at some point it started to feel like this work is missing a solid connection to the people who are most immediately impacted by U.S. foreign policy. I've had this underlying need to go to a place and meet people who are on the other end of the portion of my tax money that goes to fund the U.S. and other militaries." And in January 2003, Rachel traveled to Israel, the West Bank, and finally to Gaza. I like to use a map. I just want to share a little bit with you. Yesterday, Craig put up the wrong map, so I had to check it. Make sure we have the right one here. But Gaza, just as for a little review, is bordered by Egypt, Israel, and the Mediterranean Sea. One thing I just want to point out, is that you see that distance between Gaza and the West Bank. And we heard about the difficulty or the process of getting out of Gaza, Lama not being able to get here, the challenges that our young Palestinians go through in order to come here. But one thing I want to point out is that there are so many forms that this takes. And one is that we know people in Gaza who have family members in the West Bank. The people, part of the family in the house where Rachel stood, had a sister in the West Bank they hadn't seen in 10 years. That distance is like, should be like an hour drive, I think, roughly. And yet they're not able to get together. Just wanted to point that out to you. Gaza is approximately 30 miles long, 4 to 8 miles wide. Its land area is 139 square miles. I meant to look this up, but I think it's maybe a quarter of the size of Cape Cod, somewhere in that vicinity. It has 10 times the population. I know your population increases here in the summertime, but I think generally it has, Gaza's about 10 times more populated. When Rachel was there, there were 1.7 million people. It now hovers around 2 million. Today, more than 65% of the population of Gaza are under the age of 25. And I'd like to re-emphasize that. More than 65% of the population under the age of 25. According to Gisha, which is an Israeli legal organization that works on the movement and on the issues people in Gaza face, in 2018, unemployment in Gaza reached 52%. And for women, it was 74.5%. Unemployment figures have been even higher for that large young population under the age of 25. The restrictions on access to Gaza began in the 1990s. Access was easier in 2003 when Rachel was there than it is today. This is because of the severe blockade, siege, and closure of Gaza that Israel has imposed since the Hamas party prevailed in the 2007 elections. Israel controls the land, air, and sea access. In 2003, with other international activists, Rachel lived with and built relationships with Palestinian families in Rafah along the Gaza-Egypt border, whose homes were at risk of demolition by the Israeli military, and who welcomed international solidarity. She slept at water wells to protect them from demolition. She worked with children's and women's groups and Gaza human rights organizations, and she planned her connections with counterparts in our community of Olympia through a sister city project. She wrote at a very small internet cafe into the wee hours of the mornings to get stories out to our family, friends, and the international media. She wrote to the children, who couldn't even believe that a place like this existed. But even more, can you believe there are children here? Forget the fear. They tell me that at night. Forget the fear. I am ashamed that I am scared for my own body and dying anonymously inside a house in one of the most populous places on earth, where children die as martyrs of the occupation, which we pay for quietly without ever knowing their names. We need more people. I love all of you. Rachel. In 2003, the Israeli military was engaged in massive home demolitions to expand the Philadelphia Corridor, a narrow strip under Israeli control between the border of Gaza and Egypt. The BBC and others reported that Israeli Colonel Yom Tov Samia had stated on military radio that Israeli forces must raise all the houses within a strip 300 to 400 meters wide in Rafah refugee camp. That no matter what the future agreement with the Palestinians would be, this would be the Israeli border with Egypt. That Arafat must be punished. And after each incident of Palestinian resistance, another two to three rows of houses must be raised. Clearly, this was collective punishment and a war crime. In our legal proceedings in Israel in 2010 and 11, the deputy battalion commander for the southern Gaza Strip was asked by our attorney how far the Philadelphia corridor extended. His reply was, up to the next row of houses. In their report titled Raising Rafah, Human Rights Watch noted that between September 2000 and September 2004, more than 10% of the population of Rafah, more than 16,000 people, lost their homes. Many were dispossessed for a second or third time. Human Rights Watch stated the pattern of destruction strongly suggests that Israeli forces demolish homes wholesale, regardless of whether they posed a specific threat, in violation of international law. In most of the cases, Human Rights Watch found the destruction was carried out in the absence of military necessity. With other international activists, activist Rachel engaged in nonviolent direct action to support the families whose homes were threatened with demolition. On March 16, 2003, at about 5 p.m., as members of a Palestinian family watched through a crack in their garden wall, Rachel was run over and killed beneath a U.S.-built and funded Caterpillar D9R armored bulldozer headed directly towards the home and operated by two Israeli soldiers. At the time of Rachel's death, our family was comforted, sustained, inspired, and mentored by the human solidarity we experience from people around the world. Solidarity that after 16 years continues from Palestinians and from so many others. In 2003, a woman in Israel wrote to her friend in our town of Olympia, and the friend passed this message on to me. We need all our young people, ours and theirs. A woman in New York State wrote, my grandparents fled the pogroms of Russia 100 years ago and spent decades working for the creation of a Jewish homeland. I'm certain that if they were alive, they would weep for all that is happening there now, as I do. And a gentleman in the Middle East wrote, I write to you as a parent myself, and also as a Muslim who believes passionately in the freedom and dignity of every individual on our earth. It seems to me that we too carelessly forget or disbelieve our shared identity across all times and cultures, when in fact we are one human family desperately in need of peacemakers. What have I learned about solidarity from my daughter and from Craig's and my own experience these past 16 years? And I have to say I'm delighted to hear that I think we share a lot of views about solidarity. I wanted to just share some of what I think is key for us all to remember as we move forward together in solidarity with Palestinians and with all who are oppressed. Rachel chose to go to Gaza with a Palestinian-led movement, the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, committed to resisting the entrenched, systematic oppression and dispossession of the Palestinian population. I learned that in our work we must elevate and prioritize Palestinian voices and the voices of those who live with the injustices. They must always be at the source of our discussion and always be a part of our discourse. Rachel saw connections between issues. From Gaza, she wrote, what we are paying for here is truly evil. The largest evil I have witnessed directly. Maybe the general growing class imbalance in the world and the consequent devastation of working people's lives all over the world is a bigger evil. Maybe being here should make me more aware of what it might mean to be a farmer in Colombia right now. 16 years later, Craig and I and our colleagues talk about the intersections between issues, the need to include in our discussions those who work on indigenous rights, on opposing racism, on disproportionate police violence against people of color and of their incarceration, on the treatment of human beings at our borders, and more. A Palestinian colleague said in a recent U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights webinar that simply showing up for those who work on these related issues is doing Palestine solidarity work. The Palestinian struggle must now be one for universal human rights. Rachel wrote, what is privilege? It is the thing that is uncomfortable to say. Your secret kinship with Sam Walton. Any advantage you enjoy based on your position in a society. Anything unearned, arbitrary. What is white skin privilege? White skin privilege is the giant iceberg looming beneath the tip that is security checks at the airport. 16 years later, those of us who have lived privileged lives and have benefited from racial, ethnic, economic, or other privilege know that we have much listening, learning, and and self-examination to do. We must be on guard, watching for how our own internalized privilege makes way for hierarchies and confiscation of power. As we do this necessary work, we humbly ask for guidance and for some forgiveness, because there is need in this movement for all of us. Rachel wrote, "I look forward to all of us who are new at this, developing better skills for working in democratic structures and healing our own racism and classism and sexism and heterosexism and ageism and ableism and becoming more effective." Rachel valued commitments and said, "I continue to believe that my home, Olivia, could gain a lot and offer a lot by deciding to make a commitment to Rafa in the form of a sister-community relationship. Many people want their voices to be heard, and I think we need to use some of our privilege as internationals to get those voices heard directly in the U.S. rather than through the filter of well-meaning internationals such as myself." Solidarity calls for commitment. Rachel's was to Gaza and to its children, both of which cry out to us for further attention. In Rachel's journal, one of her many lists is titled "Identifying Baby Steps," followed by a string of small to-do items that would eventually make her trip to Palestine a reality. I have learned that the baby steps, yours and mine, and of all these steps being taken by others around the country who work with us for change, are cumulative, and they are making a difference. We are changing the discourse on the issue of Palestine here in the United States. And we are elevating discussion of all the related social justice issues that must be addressed as we work for a more gentle and just country and world. Martin Luther King wrote, "If you can't fly, then run. If you can't run, then walk. If you can't walk, then crawl. But whatever you do, you have to keep moving forward." And in Gaza, Rachel wrote, "This has to stop. I think it is a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop. I don't think it's an extremist thing to do anymore. I still really want to dance around to Pat Benatar and have boyfriends and make comics for my coworkers, but I also want this to stop." So we have our marching orders. They're working on us, goes on. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. And I want to talk to you about a few things, but it's really neat because most of it's already been covered. So you've heard a lot of detail about what goes on in Israel and Palestine, and I taste a lot, so if you can't see the screen, I'll move in a second and I'll give you something to think about while I'm talking. But, so if you draw back maybe up to a really high level to think about what's going on over there, it's pretty obvious. And so, how many of you have seen these four maps before? So, yeah, okay, so I'll leave that. How many of you have seen this map before? You know what that is? Do you have it? Yeah.
I can see it right there. It's where we have set a sideline for Native Americans.
Yeah, it's what we've done. It's the counterpart. If you would think 500 years ago, all this would have been orange. It would have all been the Native Americans. But that's what we've done. So I like to tell people when I talk, we need to be a little bit humble. Because while, you know, we're all settlers here, unless your ancestors walked here from Asia. So, you know, just think about it. In 2009, Cindy and I were privileged to go on our third of five trips to Gaza. And this was with Code Pink. And you see that? How many of you know about Code Pink? Okay, I don't have to explain that. So I was with the male auxiliary of Code Pink there. And 2 days later, I believe it's March 8th, that is International Women's Day. And so the women went out and did whatever the women do when they get together in Gaza. And the men had a separate trip that we went on. And so I don't have pictures. Cindy had the camera. But I remember very specifically, we did a number of groups, but we got in with some young people, under 30, I think, for the most part, who were working in TV and radio, but they were the ones at that time that were up on the roof. And this is 2009, so it's right after what the Israelis called Casbah, the attack on the Gaza Strip. And they were the ones that had the upload to the Al Jazeera satellite, which allowed what little information we managed to get from the Gaza Strip. These were the people that were doing that. And we have about four people that can translate for us into Arabic and back into English and everything, but the discussion around the table was so intense that our translators all started arguing, and I got very little of it, but it was delightful, just the same. And so, at one point, one of the women there in the group, young woman, looked at us and she said, "This was so bad that if somebody came here from Israel, I would say, it is not enough that you look and say, I'm sorry. I would ask them, what will you do when you go back home?" And so the arguments went on for about 10 minutes, and finally I turned to this woman. I said, "Well, we're not from Israel. All but one of us is from the United States. But any four-year-old child there can pick up a piece of armament and show you where it says made in the USA. They know where the armaments, they know where that jet came from, they know all of that." So I said, "You know, what would you say to us from the United States?" And she stopped and she said to each of us, "What will you do when you go back to the United States?" And she waited for the answer until we came up with a promise to her. Now, when she's doing that, this is what went on behind that. You know, Casbah, Palestinians, 1,342 Palestinians were killed in that attack. There were 13 Israelis that were killed. Wounded, over 5,300 of the Palestinians, 197 Israelis. Homes destroyed, 3,500 or more, no Israelis. Buildings from the Palestinian side, 1,200 or more. Greenhouses, 80 or more. And tens of thousands left homeless. So that gives you the picture. Except it doesn't give you the picture. That's the picture just east of Gaza City. You look out over that, you can see in the distance Israel on a road there that their invasion came down. Now if I turned, and I did, but I'm going to show you all the pictures, but you turn the camera either direction, north or south, and it just continues for kilometers there. That total destruction. Some people were trying to live in the houses after they'd been destroyed like that. There was a man living in a tent underneath that concrete house, that was his living conditions. But beyond that, there are all these tents. Now, you know, I might let my brother-in-law live in a tent rather than moving in with me. But in Gaza, that's not the way it works. If you see tents like that, it's because the whole extended family's houses have been destroyed. Or their extended family's house is full. And I don't mean full by Western standards. I mean 20, 40 people inside that house. They won't be out in the tents unless there's no other way to do it. But that's where they were. That's what was making that woman that angry, that she's saying, "What will you do?" And making us answer. And so that's my question to you. What will you do once you've met these people from the West Bank, heard about this, and in going back? I've got some suggestions for you about what to do, and you can take these or figure out something else. So HR 2407, that's introduced into the house by Betty McCullough. She's from St. Paul, Minnesota. I've heard her talk, Cindy and I managed to hear her talk about a year ago. Compelling. But what this bill does, in reality, what it does is say that the U.S. will not fund foreign military when those funds are used to put young children in jail. So it is written with the intention of applying to Israel, but it would apply anywhere in the world. Unfortunately, it's not going to apply on our borders because it's our military that are putting those, or our government kids in jail. But I did read recently, a couple of days ago, Cindy was reading on the web that you're going to have to help me out, the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Council has endorsed this bill, and the reasoning for that was that they were very much against what was happening on the children on the border, and they couldn't come out against the sort of thing that was happening on our border without also coming out against what was going on in Israel. So that, to me, is a very courageous stand on that. So I'd like you to go, call, write, do both. You're a member of Congress, and then keep coming back. Keep coming back. And do that, not sort of in their face. Try to get a vote, because you're trying to convince somebody. You're trying to, you want your congressperson to be successful, and you want him to be successful at your issue. So just keep going in there. And if you're really lucky and really persistent, they may call you when they want advice about what's going on over there, another perspective. And that's where you want to get to, if it's at all possible. So I urge you to do that. You can lobby your state legislature. We've talked a little bit about BDS, since the other hand, I'll ask you how many people know what BDS is. Okay, so let's practice it, but also go to your state legislature. I don't believe Massachusetts has any laws that they put into effect against BDS. But they're around the country, and they may come here, and just going in and talking to them, even if there's nothing effective, easier if there's nothing in front of the legislature. And what I like to say is that, you know, you don't wait until you've got chicken pox to cure. You take an inoculation. Just go to your state legislator and inoculate about this. And it may be really gratifying. It was for Cindy and me. We went to a very religious right-wing, our legislature, the legislature for in the our state legislature. He had signed on to a pretty poor bill to sign on to. And when we came in there, he looked at us and he said, "I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I did the wrong thing. I signed this and wondered, but what about the Palestinians?" And we came up to him a year later. He said, "I've read 5 books. I've seen I don't know how many films about this." And he said, "I want to go to dinner and talk to you more about it." But it's just amazing. You know, it could be good. That's all I'm saying. So try that. Go back. And then the other thing, and you can work this out with people at Tree of Life. There are people right here. They're going on a delegation soon. Travel to Palestine. Meet these kids. Eat the luba, drink the tea, and, you know, be there for yourself and see it. Because it's not, as you can see from the people here, it's not all horrible. It's also very loving, and it's just amazing, and it'll give back to you a great deal. I want you to meet one of the people, a family that we met. They're friends of Rachel. This is Om Jamil. Jamil, I think, is in there with his sibling and a neighbor of theirs. Abu Jamil was a cook, and before 2000, before the Second Intifada, he would live in the southern Gaza Strip in Rafah, but he was cooking in Tel Aviv. And you could do that. It's not that far. You could travel back and forth. But, of course, with the Second Intifada, that was all closed off. He's trapped in there, and he can't travel back and forth anymore, but Witness Square is still a good cook. So this is the their home. Right about 6 months after Rachel's killed, when we were there in 2003. That home, after we left, was destroyed. And it was so totally destroyed as we drive down that area some years later. You could not tell where the house had been. They dig in the sand, they bury everything. And there's no road left, there's no telephone pole left, there's no tree left. It is gone. And so you can't tell at all. There was really, unless you can tell there was something there throughout there, there's just no landmark to figure out what happened to Abba Junio's home. Now, here's Abba Junio, and next to Cindy is Orange Jenny, a friend of Cindy's with ISN, and then Abba Junio's family, Om Jamil, there, Jamil in front of him. And we're out there in the middle of the night. He had some land that was in a little bit east of Gaza, a little east of Rafah. And on that land, he had a tool shed or something. He expanded that when his home was destroyed, and he moved in there. And so we were coming in the evening to see him, and we had kind of like a campfire outside. Of course, we had our coffee and everything. It was a little bit surreal because we're watching a beautiful full moon rise. over there and looking at that, and then you see the F-16 flying overhead. And Amish says, no, don't worry about it unless it turns around. If it banks to turn around, then you worry. That means it's on a bombing run. But this one did not turn around that day. So we talked to him, and then we came back in the morning because Abu Jamil's second house had been destroyed. Now you think about that. No insurance. It's not like anybody's rebuilding anything. And he had a second house destroyed. The story of that is Abu Jamil was gone. Abu Jamil's home with the children, and a rocket lands in outside where the animals are. So it kills their animal, destroys their car. But Abu Jamil grabs up the children, runs to the other side, which would be the other side of the house here, with the kids, and then realizes that Jamil's not with her. So she runs back in the house, grabs the little boy, and as she's running out the door, a second rocket landed and did this destruction. But luckily, the children and the family was not hurt. But their second home destroyed here. And then Jamil's showing us this stump here. Now that was an olive tree. It was an olive tree that grew outside of his first house. And when his first house was destroyed, he dug up, transplanted that olive tree into his second house. And there it was when the rocket came and sheared it off right there. So you see what you see the stump there. And then he showed us more closely. You see there. So Gafran started us out with a little lesson in Arabic. And I would say that's the same, that is a symbol of it. That tree has sabud. It has steadfast. And Abu Jamil was saying, if this tree can live through it, I can live through it. My family can live through it. So my question to you, that you have to answer for yourselves, is do we have the sabud? What are we going to do? Because this is where we have to do something. Thank you.
That was Cindy and Craig Corey speaking at the Tree of Life conference held in Harwich on Cape Cod. And now you will hear Mark Braverman speaking at the conference when it was held in Hartford, Connecticut. Mark Braverman is an American psychologist who was active on behalf of Palestinian rights and against the Israeli occupation. Although Jewish, he is a leader of Kairos USA, a pro-Palestinian group for American Christians.
I just want to say how wonderful it is to be back with Tree of Life. This, for me, goes back about 13 years when I first met the people that work in the congregation and started this terrific foundation. And look how much the movement has grown. Bring all these wonderful people over from Palestine. It's just a terrific, terrific organization and community that I feel privileged to be part of. So we are going to go on time, so I'm going to try to be as brief as possible. I'm going to start with a story, because you know we talk about occupation, and if Craig had not beat me to it, I was also going to ask whose land are we on, and just to acknowledge that. I was in Bethlehem, maybe it was 5 years ago. I was at the Lutheran guest house in Bethlehem, Beit Jella, and a lot of American church groups come through. This was a Lutheran group, I think from Wisconsin, and they had their bishop with them. And he was going to see Palestine for the first time. And I saw him in the morning, and they introduced me to him, and I said, where are you going? He said, we're going to Hebron. I said, I want to see you when you get back from Hebron. And I did. I came back. And the man's face was white as a sheet. He had been to Hebron. And I said, well, tell me, what did you see? He said, well, we went to the settlers' community, you know, outpost, settler community inside of Hebron. You know how that works in Hebron? It's a city of 150,000 people. We heard a wonderful, wonderful presentation about Hebron. It's a big, vibrant city. And it is being held captive. All of those people are being held captive by about 600 settlers that are protected by a garrison of Israeli soldiers. And they're ready to move the city. And they've established themselves. And they're saying, we are the settlers. We are the real, we have come back. Because Jews used to live in Hebron. My grandfather was born in Hebron, a Jew. He would be horrified by what's going on now. So he says, so we walked through the closed streets, the Shahada Street, the old marketplace, the marketplace, which is now all shuttered up. It's a dead street now, which was once a live street. And we went into the little settler area, and I saw a big, big mural, a big banner. You know, it was as big as the stage. And it said, there is no Palestine, and there never will be. I said, Bishop, I'm glad you saw that, because you have now seen the real face of Israel and of Zionism. Don't let anyone tell you that these are crazy, fanatical settlers who represent some fringe element. I mean, they are crazy, they are fanatical, it is an ugly thing. But that represents the real face of Israel and what the Zionist movement is all about. It is about the erasure of Palestine. Now I ask you, after having been here tonight, has Palestine been erased? The whole Zionist movement is based on erasing the history, erasing the memory, erasing the culture. Has this culture been erased? This is resistance. What we see tonight is resistance. That much life, that much energy, that 15-year-old girl from Gaza, and the singers and the dancers that we're going to see. So it hasn't worked. I've just returned from a trip to Ireland. I was in Belfast now for the first time. Who here has been to Belfast? Okay, it's a powerful, amazing place. And what I learned about Belfast is, you know, it's a city divided into two. In the west, there's the Catholics, and in the east, there's the Protestants. There's even a wall that goes down the middle of the city. Who am I to see it? And I learned that it has nothing to do with Catholics and Protestants. It's not about religion. It's about the history of Northern Ireland, which is that colonial settlers from Scotland in the early 17th century came over and began to displace and dispossess the indigenous Gaelic Irish. And that's what this is all about, and it ain't over. And what's interesting is that Palestine figures very, very powerfully there, as it does in Brazil, where people are struggling for rights, as it does in South Africa, where people are struggling for rights. Palestine means a lot to a lot of people. And you can go to West Belfast, and you see the Palestinian flag flying, and you go to East Belfast, and you see the Israeli flag flying. It's pretty amazing. And those settlers from England who came over to occupy Northern Ireland considered themselves, and this is the word that they use, good Calvinists, the covenant people. Covenant people. God has chosen us. We are special, and God wants us to take this land. Sound familiar? We're sitting on it right now. My people, the Jewish people, feel like God, or the Bible, is a historical document and a deed to a land, and we have the right to do that. I was brought up on this. Now, the original Zionists were socialists from Russia. So they were officially atheists. They didn't believe in God, they didn't believe in the Bible. But Ben-Gurion was no dummy. He named the place Israel so that people would confuse it and associate it with Israel and the Bible. And he famously said, God does not exist, and he promised us this land. That's the way it works. And it's still happening. So I'm sometimes asked, people who are apologists for Israel, people who are concerned that to be for Palestinian rights to somehow be anti-Semitic. I just came from Germany. The Germans have a big complex about this. I talk myself blue in the face, and they still say, yeah, but we can't hurt the Jews. I say, this is not about loving the Jews. This is about loving human rights. But if you want to love the Jews, then love us properly, like you would love your alcoholic uncle who's asking for another bottle and the keys to the car. Show us some tough love. Tell us we have to stop doing this. So people say, well, you shouldn't single out Israel. This is kind of interesting. You know, everybody hates the Jews. I says, don't tell me that the state is my state. Before 1948, before the end of World War II, most of Judaism, official Jewish denominations, were officially non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. Why would we associate our faith tradition with ethnic nationalism? So this is a big, big tragedy for the Jewish people, but that's not, you know, that's our problem. The people of the world, Jews, Muslims, Christians, people who don't identify with the faith tradition, we need to do for Israel what the world did for South Africa. We can boycott, sanctions, do our best, or do our worst to make Israel feel the pain so that that government ceases to be, and all the people of Palestine, Jews and Arabs, have a chance for a decent future. The world boycotted and sanctioned South Africa was an act of love that liberated white and black from the poison that was poisoning their future and their children's future. That's what we need to be. So I'm with Craig on this. BDS is the best thing we have. And that's really what we need to focus on. And if people call you anti-Semitic, you know, wear it as a badge of honor. And tell them, excuse me, I'm not anti-Semitic. That's racism. I am not a racist. And I heard it from a Jew. Zionism is not Judaism, and the state of Israel is not the Jewish people. The state of Israel is a sovereign state. And we need to bring it back into the community of nations. I'll tell you one more story. I was in Ramallah. I was sitting with a woman named Ilana Abu Hishla, our Palestinian friends. You know this name, you know this family, right? It's an old Nablus family. Yes, and Lana she is the head of, or was the head of Mercy Corps in the West Bank in Gaza.
Global Community.
I'm sorry?
She's the head of Global Community Association.
I can't hear you, sorry.
She's the head of the Global Community Association.
Ah, yes. Well, she was with Mercy Corps, but so she's now, okay. And so I visited with her, and she was talking about how different, this was 2008, she was trying to get her people into Gaza, she was very frustrated, but she told me a story that I know she wanted me to repeat wherever I went. She lives in Sheikh Jarrah in east north Jerusalem, which is still not taken by Israel. She commutes to Ramallah every day, it's about 5 miles north south, and then back south again. And as you travel along that road, if you've been on that road to Ramallah from Jerusalem, you know that the wall, the separation wall, the apartheid wall, the land stealing wall, runs along that entire road along the west side of the road. And one day, her 8-year-old daughter, like children will sometimes do, just came out with something out of the blue. She said, Mom, why did they make the Jews live behind that wall? Now this child, and I'm thinking of Lala, she did not know that she was the one who was supposed to be the prisoner of that wall and was trying to take her land and taking away her rights. She knew who she was. She understood who were the true prisoners of that wall. Because that's what walls do. So the Palestinians are not being dispossessed. They are not being erased. The psychological and spiritual victims of that wall and the people who are doing the oppression of Palestinians will get their freedom. Let's have that slide now, okay? I just want to add this to what Craig had to say about what to do. These are just two two websites. The one is go to the Tree of Life Educational Foundation website and learn about the activities and the educational programs. And go to PalestinePortal.org, which is a program of Kairos USA, and you will find vast, deep resources for education and training in your communities, in your mosques, in your churches, in your local peace movements. You will also get news about what is happening around the world in response to the Palestinian call for BDS and also the call of the Palestinian Christians for solidarity. That is the true meaning of solidarity, and it's up to all of us. Thank you.
You have been listening to Mark Braverman speaking at the Tree of Life Conference in Hartford, Connecticut. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.